Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Welcome to Staying Connected, a podcast where I talk to other people about their stories with VEDS or vascular Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. This is your host, Katie, and before we get into the show, I want to remind you that the views, information, and opinions in this podcast are those of the individuals involved, and the information presented does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. Any opinions that I express in this podcast are my own and not of my employer. Welcome back to another episode of Staying Connected. This interview is part one of a two-part interview with Chris Schelling, CEO and founder of Acer Therapeutics, and Dr. Adrian Cortell, Chief Medical Officer of Acer Therapeutics. In this episode, part one, we will hear from Chris Schelling about Acer's pursuit of a beta blocker called Edzevo, or celiprolol, currently used in Europe for the treatment of vascular Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, or VEDS. Acer is currently enrolling people with VEDS in the United States into a clinical trial called the DISCOVER trial to see if this medication reduces events and improves survival, and to pursue FDA approval for celiprolol for VEDS. In the second part of the interview, which I've separated into a part two, we'll talk details about the DISCOVER trial with Dr. Adrian Cortell. This two-part episode is not sponsored in whole or in part by Acer. I do want to thank them for spending their time in this interview discussing celiprolol and the DISCOVER trial with me. Listen in at the end of the show for some info about community events coming up. And before we go over to the interview, if you want to support the show, consider joining my Patreon. For a few dollars a month, you can make sure the show continues to reach people around the world with real-life stories about VEDS. You can join the Patreon at the link in the episode's show notes, and you can also support the show by sharing this podcast with people you know and help us raise awareness of VEDS around the world together. Thank you so much for your support, and a huge thanks to my current patrons who have already been supporting the show. My top-tier patrons are listed in the episode show notes. All right. Thank you so much. I've got Chris Schelling here and Adrian Cortell. Thank you for joining me to talk about the DISCOVER trial for celiprolol, or Edzevo, as you call it. And really grateful for Acer doing this trial and being here to talk to me about it. Chris, do you want to go ahead and start by introducing yourself?
Sure, Katie. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. So this is Chris Schelling. I'm the CEO and the founder of Acer Therapeutics.
And Adrian, do you want to introduce yourself as well?
Yeah, thank you, Katie, and thank you for having us. I'm Adrian Cortell. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at Acer Therapeutics.
Thank you. And so the way that we're going to structure this interview is we're going to start by talking about kind of the history of celiprolol and where we are now with the trial. And then we'll, that will be mostly with you, Chris, and then we'll jump over to you, Adrian, to talk about the specifics of this trial. So, Chris, why don't you tell me a brief overview of the history of where we've come from to land at this clinical trial in the United States for Edzevo?
Sure. So it's an interesting kind of story. I formed Acer in 2013, really after I left BioMarin, to focus on getting drugs to patients as quickly as possible. And those were really patients with, extremely rare diseases where there's a significant unmet medical need. And we formed the company originally around another asset, a drug we called Acer-001. It's now called OLPRUVA. It's FDA approved to treat a genetic disease called urea cycle disorders. And in late 2014, Dr. Brendan Lee, who's the chair of genetics at Baylor College of Medicine, he's a good friend. He reached out to me and suggested that we should consider developing another drug where they treat feds patients down at Baylor, and saw the data in Europe that was generated on celiprolol in treating the VEDS patients there in France, and suggested that the drug wasn't available here in the United States, and he wanted to see the drug make its way to patients here. And so asked if we as a pharmaceutical company would be interested in developing it. So we said yes. I mean, we saw that as a great opportunity and reached out to the FDA in 2015 to have a conversation with them about what they felt was needed for us to be able to develop and bring the drug to the marketplace here in the US. So following that conversation, FDA really encouraged us to go collect the data from Europe, not only from the group in France, but also the company that owned the rights to the drug, which was a large pharmaceutical company called Sanofi, and encouraged us to go collect all the data and get the rights to the data and then submit an NDA, which is the application that the FDA requires for approval here in the US. So that was kind of the quick history on what brought us to, we weren't familiar with celiprolol and we weren't familiar with VEDS prior to the conversation with Dr. Lee. And we really weren't sure what that path might look like until we had the conversation with FDA. So that started the whole journey.
Yeah, and I'd love to talk more about the data that kind of led to the interest in celiprolol in the first place. So I think the study that you're talking about, I think there were multiple studies, but the one that I think about the most is the 2010 BBEST trial. It was like beta blockers and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome study. And is that one of the major studies that you use to kind of say, like, this is, when you talk about the data over in Europe, is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And in fact, at the time in 2015, that was really the only data that had been generated on the drug. And so that was quite literally, we went to the FDA, it was in September, late September of 2015. And the only piece of information we had was that publication. So we shared that with the division at FDA. They reviewed it and they said, look, it's very compelling, right? But they needed to see the actual data. You can't approve a drug off of a publication. So they wanted us to go and collect that data that had been generated in France and Belgium as a part of the BBEST study.
Okay. And so for someone who is unfamiliar with the BBEST study, do you want to describe that or you want me to take a stab at it?
Yeah, I'm happy to. And if you want to add color, that'd be great. So maybe I can provide even a little history on the BBEST study. So the drug celiprolol had actually originally been approved by Sanofi in Europe in the 1980s. And at that time, the drug only had one, kind of really known mechanism of action, which was a beta blocker, a beta 1 antagonist. So it was approved to treat high blood pressure, but it wasn't a particularly good blood pressure drug. And so it kind of, it got relegated kind of to the back because there's a lot of beta blockers that are approved, kind of got relegated to the back of the pack in terms of drugs to use. Clinicians began to understand that it had other mechanisms of action, including a beta 2 agonism, which most beta blockers don't have. And so interestingly, beta 2 is relevant in asthma. And the fact that this was a beta 2 agonist suggested that the drug could be used in asthmatics where all the other beta blockers couldn't. They were contraindicated for those patients. And so so that was kind of the niche area that this drug was used for, was asthmatics who had high blood pressure. A cardiologist in France was familiar with it because he'd prescribed it to his patients and started looking further into the mechanisms of the drug and realized actually that it had kind of a broad range of mechanisms, how the drug was working in the body. And because of that, he began doing some animal research. This was in the late 90s. And then began testing it in some of his patients and realized that the drug, in fact, wasn't really a good beta blocker, but actually was a better drug for some of these other things that were going on where they would induce vasodilatation, so the widening of the arteries, and relaxation of the muscle in the blood vessels. And thought that because he treated VEDS patients, that this would be a particularly helpful and unique drug for those patients. And so he began the BBEST trial really in right around 2000, 2001, and began enrolling patients in 2002, to see whether the drug actually could have benefit in the VEDS patients.
So there are some things that I've heard as an individual with VEDS about that study. And to date, I think it's the only, from my knowledge, I think it's the only like clinical trial in VEDS that has been with published data that has had like a placebo arm, like a control group. And what I've known about that study is that it was, very small, like 57, maybe I think, somewhere in the 50s patients. And then that partway through that study, they genetically tested everybody in there, and about 30% of the patients did not have VEDS. So it kind of messed up the balance of the two arms. So that's like the that's the only not like not the only knowledge I have of that study, but that is a piece of knowledge that I have as an individual with VEDS that makes me wonder how valid the results of that study were. Just because I do know like they stopped that trial early because the data was so positive is what it says in this study. Do you want to say anything more about that?
Yeah, I mean, so I think generally speaking, you're spot on. I mean, it randomized 53 FEDS patients. The intent of the study actually was to enroll 100 patients, and they had several hundred patients in France. They thought it was not going to be any difficulty to enroll the patients. So they did 100. It was going to be 50 in each arm, the treatment arm and the control arm. And what happened was, as they began enrolling the study, this was a drug again that was available at the pharmacy there in Europe. And so as patients began to learn about the study and about the potential benefit, you had a chance. I mean, I put myself in the patient's shoes there. You have a chance to be randomized to a drug or no drug for 5 years. And if you're in the no drug arm, that's a scary thing, right? To be like, oh, for 5 years, I can't go on any other medicine. I can't do anything about it. I'm here. And so what happened was is that they only ended up randomizing 53 patients because all of the patients that they knew about just went to the pharmacy and got on drug. And so it made it really difficult for them to enroll the study. So they broadened it out to other sites throughout France and Belgium. And ultimately they enrolled patients in the study for over 5 years. And at some point they were like, look, there's no way we're going to get 100 patients like we planned. And so we have to at some point, call it and quit enrolling and look at the data, right? Now, remember, they weren't interested in getting the drug approved in Europe. Their goal was to see if the drug worked and if it was safe. And they felt like that they accomplished that when they looked at the data, right? They were able to look at it in a blinded fashion and realize, wow, there's a big difference between the two arms. And the thing was, and when we talked with the primary investigator over there, Dr. Boutwiri, he said, look, if it was the no treatment arm, those patients were having the benefit, and the treated arm were doing that poorly, he had to stop it because he had, obviously that would be a detriment to the patients. Alternatively, if the treatment arm was having that kind of benefit relative to no treatment, he felt that it was an ethical thing to do to stop the trial because it's not fair to keep patients on the no treatment arm. And that's exactly what he did. So they unblinded it and they realized that there was the benefit that was there. But that was the problem with the study, right? Is that they wanted to enroll 100, they only enrolled 53% of the study. You mentioned a thing about the COL3A1 patients, right? The genetic testing. And so again, we look at it through our lens today. We're like, of course, everybody gets genetically tested. But in the early 2000s in Europe, that was actually not the standard way to diagnose patients. The standard way was through the Villefranche criteria, which was phenotypically like, what are your symptoms and do you have major and minor symptoms? And if you score high enough, then you'd be diagnosed with VEDS. It didn't guarantee that you had COL3A1 disease, but it did mean you had a vascular, very similar type disease to VEDS. And so you're right, there were 33 patients that were confirmed COL3A1, which means that 20 patients either weren't known because they didn't collect the data or they were negative for COL3A1. And so the clinicians in Europe at that time didn't have a concern. It was not an enrollment criteria for the study. It wasn't a part of it. It was a nice to have, not a need to have at the time because they felt confident in the Villefranche criteria. Of course, now we recognize that COL3A1 is the gold standard. That's what you have to do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was a totally different time, and that's a good point to make, right? I also liked your, I appreciated your distinction about celiprolol being available in Europe as just a standard beta blocker at that time. And I think that's a really important distinction, about celiprolol here in the U.S. is that it is not approved as a beta blocker here in the United States. That's do you correct. Know why that is?
I do, actually. So Sanofi, at the time, they were called Rhône Plank Roar. It was, you know, as companies merged together, they changed their names. And we refer to it as RPR. RPR in the late 80s had, in fact, in 1987, had submitted an NDA with the FDA for approval for lowering blood pressure. And the story that's been told to us by individuals who are there at RPR suggested that the FDA was not interested in approving the drug because it wasn't a particularly good beta blocker. And they said, look, we've already got, I don't know, 8 to 10 drugs that do this. We don't need another one. And the story goes that they invited the folks from RPR out to a meeting and said, you have two options. We're either going to not approve your drug or you can withdraw your application. And apparently that's exactly what they did. They withdrew the application and the drug was never approved.
Okay. So it's essentially there were better beta blockers in the United States available at the time already. And celiprolol, as you described, like in France or in Europe, was like, you know, not the best at blood pressure reduction.
That's right.
Right. So what other data informs kind of your pursuit of celiprolol here in the United States for events?
So obviously the BBEST study, even though it has its shortcomings, right, in the COL3A1 population, when you look at the 33 patients that had, you know, confirmed genetic disease, you still see tremendous benefit in the treatment arm versus the control arm from that study. It's small. But this is a rare disease and small numbers aren't, they're not scary to the FDA. This is something that a lot of rare disease companies deal with in trying to get the drug approved is small number of patients. And so I think that, you know, when you look at that data, it looks very compelling, even though as a trial, like, it wasn't acceptable to the FDA on its own merits to support the approval when we were trying to get approval in the drug in 2018. But after that trial was done, and again, remember the drug was available. So when they opened the following these patients up, there was actually 144 patients that were enrolled in a registry, where it was kind of open label. So people could be on drug or they could be on something else if they wanted to. They just kind of followed all patients. And, what they found in there in that study was that, patients who were, received celiprolol either by itself or with some other drug ended up having, not just did it reduce the events that they were having, like the BBEST study was tracking, like how long did it take for you to have a VEDS related event? That was BBEST, but the registry actually looked at, did that translate into patients living longer? And so the registry followed these patients for up to 17 years. And again, 144, 100% of the patients they enrolled in this, by that time, by 2010, they were all COL3A1 positive in the registry. And what they found was that, in fact, the survival, people live longer by being on celiprolol than those who never received celiprolol. So it was a registry. It's not acceptable to the FDA for helping to get the drug approved here. But it is very compelling data in the sense that obviously if you can prevent an event from a VEDS-related event from occurring, people should live longer. And that's, in fact, what they saw.
So that's interesting. So that is the study from the French group that I think I saw published in 2019. Is that right? Yep. Okay. So when I read that, I found it so fascinating. And I'm curious, you know, you mentioned this too. It's open label, right? So people can be on drug or not. There's no randomization. There's no control arm to that study. But I believe more than 90% of people were on celiprolol. And those results of the study, I mean, they had analyzed a bunch of different reasons and resources that people with VEDS had available to them. Namely, they're being treated at a center that treats 144. Like, if you're one individual with VEDS there, then you're being treated by somebody who is also treating 143 other people. And I think that that's pretty significant. For me, when I, you know, in the U.S., when I think about if I want to see a doctor who treats five patients or 143, I'm not sure, who treats 143 patients in the United States because our healthcare system is totally different than it is in France. So that was one thing. They had access to essentially an expert center treating a lot of patients. But I think in the results of that study, they also mentioned, an emergency, like a 24-hour emergency line. So if you're having an emergency, you can call. And the center there is well established for emergencies because the nature of how many people with beds that they treat. And I believe I saw in the discussion of that study that they couldn't conclude that celiprolol was the reason that people were living longer because they had access to this expert center, this emergency line. They were getting routine follow-up and imaging and being treated kind of proactively. And I'm not, I guess what I'm asking, my lead up to this, I guess, is, what data did they compare survival rate to? If they're not comparing, were they comparing the 90% plus people who were on celiprolol to the very few in that study who were not? Or were they comparing it to a different number, a different survival rate, or that was perhaps 10 years prior, 15 years prior, without all of those resources.
Yeah, I think no, it's a great question, and I think so. Let me characterize or clarify one thing. I think they could conclude that celiprolol did have benefit in those patients. What they couldn't exclude was the significant benefit of being treated in a care center. So it's just kind of flipping that upside down. So I think that they said, look, obviously these patients, they're having benefit from being on drug, but we can't rule out what the impact of being treated at a tertiary care center was, right? So obviously you need to do a much larger trial that could say, in the non-celiprolol treated arm, treated at the same centers, did they still have the same survival, right? And they couldn't exclude that. That there was just too small of an N in the non-celiprolol treated arm to be able to conclude that, right? But they still felt like the celiprolol did give benefit to those patients. They just can't tease out the difference in what the impact was for both of those things, which frankly, if I'm a vets patients in Europe, I don't care. To be at a center of excellence, getting a drug, and I'm living longer, hey, that's great, right?
Yeah,
So.
I mean, I think it was a very, ultimately, it was a very hopeful study because it showed, regardless of the reason, people with VEDS in France in this study were doing, very well compared to historical data.
Yeah, and the historical data that you can compare it against the non-celiprolol treated arm in that registry, you also have a natural history that, as you I think alluded to, that was published about 10 years earlier here in the U.S. that looked at the natural history of VEDS patients here, and that survival curve that was seen in the natural history, which would be non-celiprolol treated patients here in the U.S., was very similar to the survival curve in the non-celiprolol treated patients there in France. And so when you kind of calculated the data and built those lines over each other, those two lines actually almost perfectly overlapped. And then you had the celiprolol arm that went much longer. So it's yeah, you have to kind of triangulate data. It's not a perfect science, but it does directionally, I think, give some comfort that there's some potentially some additional benefit by adding celiprolol to the standard of care.
Yeah, and has there been any post follow-up, I guess post and follow-up are really the same word, right? Follow-up studies comparing, people on celiprolol with people on different beta blockers to see if this, like, how do you then say it's if being on celiprolol is helpful, how do you then say being on a different beta blocker instead is not? Is that going to be something that you pursue later, after this current trial that you're running?
Yes and no. So what I would say is this. I would say that physicians in Europe have all antihypertensive drugs to use at their disposal, right? I think it's really important, and I'm sure Adrian will probably provide a little of additional color on this, but it's important to note that in the BBEST study, there were no differences when people were on celiprolol in terms of their blood pressure, right? So most of the people were normotensive. Most VEDS patients are normotensive. And what we actually saw in the treatment arm versus the control arm was that blood pressure was not lowered any more in the treatment arm than they were in the control arm. So the drug, kind of in line with what we always expected, it's not a good blood pressure lowering drug. So the benefit seen in BVEST isn't usually attributed to the ability to lower blood pressure. I think clinicians in Europe typically aren't trying to lower blood pressure in VEDS patients. So, you know, here in the United States, you look at celiprolol and you think, okay, it's a beta blocker. Maybe we'll use it here. And that's logical. Or maybe we'll put you on an ARB or an ACE or something like that. But the goal isn't really to lower blood pressure. And certainly celiprolol, that wasn't where the benefit was seen. So I don't know if inducing hypotension or lowering blood pressure to a significant degree is really the treatment goal. I think certainly some of those patients have high blood pressure, and that would be a risk factor. And in those patients, you'd want to lower blood pressure. But for everyone else who's normotensive, that's really not the issue. Second point that maybe getting a little technical here. So when you look at beta receptors, beta 1, beta 2, we talk about these things. What's interesting is that the number associated with the beta adrenergic receptors really has to actually do with the anatomy of the body and where those receptors are found. So beta 1 is typically found in the heart, and beta 2 is found in the periphery. And so when you're talking about lowering blood pressure centrally at the heart, you know, what you're trying to do is saying that you're changing the way that the blood is being distributed throughout the body by impacting it. That's why beta blockers often lower heart rate, right? And so that's a big impact that's there. And then you've got these other beta 2, beta 3 receptors, alpha receptors that are in different places and do different things. And so I think what you have is, you know, really not a desire in Europe, where they have everything, not a desire to try to treat the blood pressure, but rather trying to treat other aspects of the disease with a drug like celiprolol. Unfortunately, in the US, you know, it has a unique profile. There's not a real comparable drug here in the US to celiprolol that clinicians can use to try to get the same type of benefits. So those that are using blood pressure medicine, and I'm not a doctor, so I'm not trying to give medical advice here. I just want to be very clear. But those that are on antihypertensive agents here in the US, that might not be the whole picture in terms of how celiprolol is potentially benefiting VEDS patients.
You know, and I think that's a perfect lead-in to where we are today, is now you have this clinical trial that you are currently enrolling for celiprolol here in the United States. And do you want to talk any more about the history of, like, you know, 2019 to now? Because in 2019, you know, the FDA denied the application for, you know, the approval of celiprolol as an orphan drug proven to help people with VEDS. Is that the right way to say that?
Yeah, I think so. So, and I can provide a little bit of color on that now because we've got some separation from it. So we submitted the application as the FDA requested of us in late 2018. They reviewed it quickly because they recognized this is a huge unmet need. And in June of 2019, they gave us what's called a complete response letter, which meant they could not approve the drug based off of the data that we provided in our application. And just trying to like simplify the response from the FDA, the hallmark of the rejection had to do with the fact that the trial, as you alluded to earlier, they stopped it early, right? They knew they weren't going to enroll all the patients. But there's a technical feature of clinical trials. It's not just let's go run the trial and see what happens. There's statistics and there's protocol and there's deviations and all this kind of fun stuff. And in the BBEST study, when you start a trial, you're not supposed to stop it early unless you run the statistical calculation, and it's called the stopping criteria. So you have to cross that line. You have to meet that threshold to say, okay, we're stopping because the data, without being unblinded, the data crossed that line, and therefore we feel safe that we can unblind it and look at the data. The reality is that the investigators in Europe, they did not cross that line because the trial was underpowered. They only had, you know, 53% of the trial enrolled, which makes it really difficult to be able to meet that criteria because they set it in the very beginning of the study. They had no idea how the study was going to go. And by the time they stopped the trial, obviously it was coming up short. So that was kind of the hallmark of the reason why the FDA didn't come in and say, oh, the drug doesn't work. or, oh, this is a small trial. It really centered around the fact that statistically speaking, the stopping criteria for the study had not been met. And therefore, when it's not met, all of the stats that support the data and the analysis really couldn't be interpreted by the agency in order to come to a conclusion definitively that the efficacy of the drug was met in that trial. So usually the FDA wants two studies run independently and then that show the same result. But in rare diseases, they'll oftentimes allow one study to be done. And if you're going to rely on one study, it has to be overwhelmingly positive. And we ran into this problem, obviously, from a statistical perspective, that they couldn't rely on the data there to be able to support approval on a single study. So that's why the drug was rejected. And I'll say, you know, we tried really hard to get the drug approved for patients here because we recognize what an unmet medical need it is. And clinicians were asking us to get the drug approved for their patients. And so we appealed that decision in 2020, right before COVID. And, you know, we got some really great feedback from the FDA in terms of, hey, we really like this. This data looked really good in the COL3A1 population. That was really strong. And yet it's not enough. You have to go do a second study to confirm the results. So it's not by chance that this was great data. You have this other study over here that proves it. So he, you know, Dr. Peter Stein was the head of Office of New Drugs at FDA. And he said, look, go back and work with the division and see if you guys can come up with a creative study design that allows us to confirm the efficacy results from BBEST study. And so we did. We went back in 2021, had the conversation with them, came up with this kind of creative design that Adrian's going to talk about here. It's a decentralized trial design. In fact, it was actually an idea that the division gave us in terms of how to approach studying this in terms of a decentralized trial. And so we took that and ran with it and ultimately got to a place where the division and the company were pretty happy with, you know, conducting this study that's now known as the Discover trial.
Yeah, and I'm super excited to talk about this. And Adrian, I'm so glad that you're here to join me too. And Chris, I just want to say thank you for, you know, filling in some of that history there. And as a patient, you know, with the condition myself, or a person with the condition myself, I really appreciate that there is this Discover trial that is going on to say definitively. Because as a patient, you know, when there's very limited data, it's hard for me to wrap my head around the treatment being like absolutely solid and me wanting to jump on that treatment wagon without that data. So to me, I think that this trial that we're going to talk about with Adrian is so important to answer that question definitively, whether or not celiprolol is effective for people with VEDS. So thank you so much for coming on and talking to me about that. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Absolutely. Thanks, Katie.
Thank you for listening to part one of this two-part episode featuring Acer Therapeutics and the Discover trial. Don't miss part two with Dr. Adrian Quartel, where we discuss the details of the trial itself. There are quite a few events you can participate in the next few weeks to raise awareness of VEDS, meet others, and learn from the experts. First, Reds for VEDS Day is less than 1 week away on May 19th. This is an international event where we all wear red to raise awareness of VEDS around the world. Be sure to wear red on May 19th and share a picture on social media using the hashtag #RedsForVEDS. Also, the Marfan Foundation is hosting in-person walks for victory around the United States. These are fundraisers, but they're also an opportunity to connect with others in the community locally. In May and June, join community members at these events in Aptos, California, Seattle, Washington, New York City, New York, Boston, New England, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Chicago, Illinois, and Ann Arbor, Michigan. I've created a team VEDS for the Seattle Walk for Victory, and I hope to meet those of you in the Pacific Northwest at this event. I've put a link to my team down in the episode show notes. And coming up right around the corner is a Foundation's conference held this year in Chicago, July 13th to 16th. The Ehlers-Danlos Society will also be hosting a VEDS camp in partnership with the VEDS Movement, division of the Marfan Foundation, the weekend prior to the Foundation conference at Camp Joy, Ohio. This is July 7th to 9th. Links to more information about these events can be found in the episode show notes. Don't forget to subscribe to Staying Connected on your podcast player so you don't miss any future episodes. And if you like this show, I hope you will consider sharing it with your friends on social media to help us raise awareness of EDS together. You can also support the production of this podcast by joining my Patreon. The link is in the episode show notes. Thanks so much, and I will see you in part two of this interview with Dr. Adrian Cortell.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.